It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We learn about what's called incidental taking of wild plants and animals that are listed as endangered and threatened species in Wisconsin and how the DNR regulates these permits, like in the case of moving a wild animal to make way for a new subdivision. Call in with your questions about the incidental take permit under Wisconsin law, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Rory Pulaski is here, a conservation biologist and the incidental take coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Rory, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So under state law, the DNR must be notified whenever a construction project is proposed in an area where threatened or endangered species are known to live. So let's work with that scenario for a moment. Can you walk us through the state's current permitting process?
Yes. So currently, when we have projects that could impact a state endangered or threatened animal or plant, a lot of times we will have the applicant do what we call removals or regulatory removals at the site. And so what that entails is, say we have a commercial development that may be happening, you know, could be 2 acres of a project. And what we require under this permit often is that a biologist, typically an environmental consultant in Wisconsin, will go to that site, often put fencing up around the project area, and then try to remove as many of the endangered or threatened animals from the site before the project occurs. So the permit allows us to still have development moving forward in areas, but it minimizes to the extent we possibly can the impacts to the rare species.
So we have a clear picture in our mind. The incidental taking might mean, you know, inside that fence line, if you will, you'd relocate that animal or that plant to somewhere else. You also might shoot it. Can you explain what things fall under incidental taking?
Yes. So incidental taking is kind of a fancy legal term.
Thank you for acknowledging that.
Yes. So take is another word for, generally it refers to mortality or moving of an animal. And then the incidental portion is meaning that it's incidental to another legal activity, lawful activity that's occurring. So the development's going in, of course, their first intent is not to kill all the animals in the area, it's to put in a development. So incidental taking generally refers to projects where we think there could be mortality of an animal. And in this situation, it gets a little complicated, but part of that definition also allows for handling or removing animals from a site. So we kind of use it in both ways.
So take us to the present, to the DNR proposing this new system where your agency would issue a one-time permit to remove and relocate animals from sites. How would this this proposed permitting process be different from what's going on now?
Right. So it's similar to what we're doing right now. We are already have the environmental consultants around Wisconsin doing this work, and we work very closely with them. When we have, you know, an application we get for this kind of work, we ensure that the person is qualified. They know the species well. They know what they're looking for, how to remove it, where to remove it. And so this new permit is similar, but it's just streamlining it a bit more. And it's switching from one type of permit. It used to be called an endangered and threatened species permit. And we still have that, but that is primarily for research and education purposes. And since this is a regulatory activity, it will be covered under this new permit. It's a bit more streamlined. The applicant won't know, the applicant being the environmental consultant, won't notice a large change. One of the biggest changes is honestly the name of the permit, but also that we don't need to charge a fee for this permit, which will be beneficial in that we have a fair number of independent biologists around the state that do this work or that want to do this work for small projects to help out. And the fee can be a deterrent in some cases when this really is, you know, is the sole benefit, sole reason we're doing this is the benefit of the species to try to get them out of a project area.
I've heard it referred, though, to a blanket permit that this is moving toward. Is that not accurate?
Yes, that is a yes. We don't typically use that term, but yes,
Okay.
that's a good type of permit name for the permit. It's similar if any folks are familiar with the regulatory process at the DNR. The wetland folks have general or broad or blanket permits. So, yes, so it is a blanket permit. We can cover this, which means we don't need to public notice every single time we have someone doing this work. But we can approve it once, and then we still have all the behind the scenes checks for the person that we need to make sure again that they're qualified, that they know what they're doing, they know which species they're identifying, so that they're doing the best work they can on the site. And I should make the distinction too that there's two permits that will kind of be needed for these projects. So this one we've been talking about covers the biologist that's doing the work. And just really covers them from removing the animal and locating it, literally in most cases on the other side of the fence in suitable habitat. And the second permit is applied for by the company or the agency that's doing the work. So they actually have a separate permit. Those are generally not the blanket permits. Those are generally individual, case-by-case basis. Again, our 2-acre commercial development I mentioned, they would still come to the DNR. We'd work through a conservation plan with them, discuss how they might be able to minimize and mitigate impacts to the plant or animal. And then one of the requirements of their permit, which the individual permit they would be getting, is that they have to hire one of these qualified biologists to conduct removals, and then their project would still go to public notice. So it's
Okay.
not allowing the projects to go ahead. It's just trying to get it more streamlined for these people that are trying to, from a conservation perspective, help the species at the site.
Okay. We're talking about incidental taking and the work of protecting threatened and endangered species. Rory Pulaski is a conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. I'm curious, Rory, how many incidental taking permits might the DNR issue in a year?
That is a good question. We keep track of that and it varies, but not a lot. These individual permits, we typically issue about 15, maybe to 20 per year. So not a lot. We do have some of these broad permits. We have one that we use for grassland and savanna management in Wisconsin. Generally, we issue the broad permits when we have one type of activity and we're repeatedly issuing the same permit. It streamlines it more for us and for the applicant so that when we have the exact same permit with the exact same requirements, we're not issuing it constantly going through the longer process. And when there's not going to be as large of an impact, we can go to these broad or blanket permits. So, yeah, about 15 to 20 per year.
And has that stayed pretty steady, or does it ebb and flow?
It stays fairly steady. We've been looking at it, even during COVID, businesses slowed down a bit at the beginning, but it's surprisingly been pretty steady over the years.
Let's take a call. Marcus is in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi. What question is coming up for you?
Good morning. So I was just wondering what your guess input would be for something like bald eagles, because from what I understand, once two bald eagles become a pair and they start having chicks, typically the range that they pick, they come back or they stay in that range almost entirely. And usually they return to the same nest site year after year. So you might be able to remove them once. And I'm just curious then how that would have an effect, because I believe they're still on the endangered species list or the threatened species.
Marcus, thank you for that important scenario. Rory.
Yes, that's a good question and brings up a good point too. So the incidental take permit that we're talking about is at the state level, and it only covers endangered and threatened state-listed species. So we have two different endangered species lists we're working with. One is the state level, and then we also have the federal list, which is endangered and threatened, has endangered and threatened species. And so the bald eagle is not an endangered or threatened species in Wisconsin. It is protected federally by by a Golden and Bald Eagle Treaty Act. And so that would come into play a little bit more. So that would be a fish and wildlife permit that would be issued. So they're the federal counterpart of the DNR. But that it leads to a good question on which species we would conduct removals for. So the for birds, that would not be one that would, you're right, would not be a good fit often. It's difficult to remove birds from an area. And we do look very closely. A lot of these permits we issue are for reptiles. They're in the same area all year long. They use similar habitats. And we look at that for them as well because we have to consider the natural history, the biology of the species. And so for reptiles, for example, they have some what we call scientific term site fidelity, or they tend to imprint on a site. So we have to be very careful if we're moving the animals, we're not moving them too far. And similarly for birds too, if we would ever move them, but they would come back to a site and have the same home range, that might not be the best option. So yes, this applies for, this is used for some species, but there are definitely a lot of species that this would not be the best option for. So we would then go to a different option when we're working with a development company and find a different way to minimize and to mitigate impacts on those rare species.
Rory Pulaski is the DNR's incidental take coordinator as we explore this process of getting approval to relocate wild plants and animals. Call in with your questions about incidental take permits, what you've wondered about the state's authorization process, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about Wisconsin's incidental take permits as the agency, the DNR, accepts public comments on a proposal to streamline permits. Incidental take, referring to the unintentional loss of individual endangered or threatened animals or plants that wouldn't put the entire population of the species at risk. Join in with what's on your mind about incidental take permits, 800-642-1234. We have DNR conservation biologist Rory Pulaski. She is the agency's incidental take coordinator. Rory, I think you just mentioned lizards there just a moment ago. Which species are being removed most frequently under these permits?
Yes, so the slender glass lizard is actually one that comes up a lot for these permits. So it's our endangered species in Wisconsin. It's actually a legless lizard, so it's mistaken often for a snake. But that species is found in the west central part of the state. It's rare, very rare from a state perspective, but in certain locations, it can be fairly common in small areas. And just partly by the nature of the habitat that that species uses, kind of dry open areas, a lot of times those are suitable for development as opposed to wetlands. And the species also tends to use roadside ditches, transmission line corridors, just seems to interact or to overlap quite a bit with highly suitable areas for development. So that's one we see quite a bit.
In the winter months, though, animals like reptiles and amphibians are hibernating. Does waiting until warmer months to collect animals postpone development plans? Or what about the rhythm of these takes?
Right, that's a good question. We encourage people with these that are getting these kinds of permits or contacting us for endangered resources reviews to just determine in the beginning what species could be present. We encourage them, developers, agencies, to contact us up to a year, even more, before the project begins. So, like we mentioned before with the bald eagle, the biology of the animal is always a very important consideration to us. And we want to make sure the entire purpose of moving these animals is to help them, protect them, and we want to make sure we're doing that correctly. So, yes, for the lizard, they are a species that they're above ground in these habitats I mentioned. They don't usually migrate very far to spend their winter. Some animals do. These guys stay in the same spot and they just go underground and stay below the frost line. And so, if we were doing a development at that time, they wouldn't be out, they wouldn't be above ground. If you would dig in come across one, they wouldn't be moving very much. So in that case, yes, we always have the biology of the species at the forefront, and the work, the clearing of the site of the animals and removing them to better habitat or adjacent habitat would have to wait, would have to be done during their active season, which is generally April or May through September or October. So it's possible we might have to delay a project a bit to get to that point, but our hope is if the agency or company comes to us far enough in advance, we can plan that into to our schedule and to their schedule and not have any delays in the construction, but also make sure we're doing the work during the best time period for the animal.
Rory Pulaski, with us, conservation biologist and the incidental take coordinator for the DNR, as we talk about removal of protected animals and plants when a development moves in. You can call in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Emily is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Emily.
Hey, good morning. I was just curious for these permits, how much you consider the impact on endangered species or just habitat overall that might be affected by breaking up? Like any kind of disruption to the overall continuity of the habitat that might be caused by development, and just kind of relatedly, like how moving, relocating a species might affect the any endangered species in the area where they're relocated to.
Okay, so really looking at the overall impact of the ecosystems from where that species is now to also where they are going to be entering into. Rory, what about those considerations?
Yeah, so I am a biologist by training, so these are kind of similar thoughts that always go through my mind too when I'm issuing one of these permits. We do everything we can to keep those areas contiguous, to keep contiguous habitat, to keep larger blocks of land. And the caller's correct, this is always a consideration. This is always, almost always an issue for rare species that we're looking at habitat fragmentation. And we don't want to be fragmenting habitat, from one big piece into smaller pieces. So we look at that where possible, and we do work with the developer. If it's a commercial development, maybe a residential subdivision that's going in, that's a couple hundred acres. We will work with them. Again, if we're involved early in the process, we can work with the developer. And a lot of subdivisions now have green spaces available, and so we can work with a developer to try to put that green space in an area, keep some of the prime habitat, some of the really good habitat, keep it connected to the habitat that's outside of the development. And so there can be some design changes that go into effect to look at those kind of those cumulative effects and the habitat fragmentation to a degree.
On average, how far away might animals be relocated so they don't return?
So, and what we're looking for is just relocating. Our primary concern is relocating them for the construction process. So, a lot of times we'll have fencing that will go up around a project site. So, most people have probably seen, maybe not even paid attention to it, but if you're driving down the highway, see a project, even a road project, you may see some black fencing, erosion fencing around the site. And we use something similar in a lot of cases. So, we put that up around the project site. And in most cases, we literally just have the consultant move the animal across the fence. So it could be moved 2 feet. It
Huh,
could be
yeah.
50 to 100 feet. So it really might not be very far. And once the project's done, that fencing is taken down. And usually there's some habitat that remains in that area, like I was mentioning with the green space for a subdivision. And then we would want the animals to come back in and then use that habitat that's still there. But our real purpose is to get them out of the way for the construction activities themselves.
So as we wrap up here, the public comment period ends tomorrow for this proposal. What response have you received on the proposal?
We have gotten a fair number of questions, just wanting information on the process. And I think most folks, when they've understood the process and have gotten more information on it, don't have a lot of strong concerns either way with the permit. But we're always happy to either answer questions or take, we always want comments if people have positive or negative comments that could help us improve the permit.
Rory, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rory Pulaski is a conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR and the agency's Incidental Take Coordinator. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a writer's own food tradition.
Food can conjure up vivid memories of childhood. The tastes and smells can send us to another place while creating new memories in the moment. That's why writer Nancy Jorgensen has been thinking a lot about her German heritage and being raised on raw foods.
My cousins and I spit the last of our watermelon seeds into Nana's lawn and tumbled into the house. I was 10 years old, or maybe 6 or 12. In the kitchen, Nana leaned against the counter. She stroked my cheek with one hand and held a plate in the other, slaughtered beef, freshly ground and bloody red. Our parents circled an oak table. My uncles clutched Gettleman or Old Milwaukee and blew cigarette smoke. On the stove, pickles boiled in vinegar. The smoke and steam made my breath catch. Mother got up from the table, and in a few seconds, a knife rested in her hand. In front of her, a loaf of rye. On the counter, a shaker of salt. "Would you like some raw beef and onions?" I put out my hand. I was raised on this traditional German food, along with kraut from Nana's stoneware crock, and sausage from her hand-cranked meat grinder, oozed into animal intestine casings. We rarely ate in restaurants, our parents and grandparents creating meals from hand-tilled gardens, ancient grapevines, or a neighbor's Holstein. Now, my family often eats in restaurants. Last month, my husband Joel and I spent a week in Portland with our adult daughter, Gwen. One night in a local pub, she considered appetizers. On the menu, steak tartare. With a new name and extra ingredients, uncooked egg and capers, it was still Nana's raw beef and onions. We cook at home, too, and last week our older daughter Elizabeth prepared dinner for us. While we sipped Shiraz, she presented a tenderloin, crisp on the edges, but red and bleeding from the middle, just a few degrees past rare. Each bite, dipped in horseradish, stung my nose with a prickly ache. It took me back to Nana's garden, where that gnarly root grew among her beets and kohlrabi and turnips. I savored the burn. As Nana peeled carrots or cooked a warm potato salad dressing, she told me I was German and Pennsylvania Dutch. Her pride, like her red-checked tablecloth, underpinned every meal. It was clear my daughters inherited her German pedigree and taste for hearty dishes. A while back, Gwen, Elizabeth, Joel, and I spent 5 minutes spitting into tubes. When the results came back, Nana's genetics weren't as strong as I believed. My German DNA is less than 33%. I'm also 11% Scandinavian and 13% British. And Nana never mentioned over pork chops that I'm 8% Ashkenazi Jewish. I wonder what those ancestors would say about our habits with uncooked meat and milk from the neighbor's cow. Before the holidays this year, we planned our Christmas menu. Gwen chose pickled herring, popular with German fishermen. Elizabeth requested pretzels, a German baking tradition. And I made German apple pie. But then I whipped a pint of cream, a British birthright, and dropped meatballs in gravy, definitely Danish. We included a Mediterranean salad, Asian egg rolls, and southern pecan pie. Surveying the dishes, I realized our German heritage a muted presence. But our Wisconsin ties shouted. Piper porch wine, raised grain beer, Wisconsin-produced milk. From our own garden, pickled cucumbers, heirloom tomatoes, Duchess apples. a bounty of food and tradition as wide as the world and as narrow as Wisconsin.
Nancy Jorgensen is a writer based in Waukesha, and her story is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. And we want to hear about your own food traditions. Share them with us on Instagram. Just search for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Winter can be an especially hard season for people without homes. But in rural communities, housing insecurity can be difficult to measure and address. WPR's Lee Rayburn spoke with two leaders of local organizations that serve people experiencing homelessness. Michael Hall is Associate Director of Foundations for Living in Waupaca County. And Brad Paul is Executive Director of Wisconsin Community Action Program Association, or WISCAP. Lee first spoke with Brad Paul about WISCAP, a statewide network of organizations fighting poverty.
Introduce us a little bit to WISCAP and the work that you do every day.
Sure. WISCAP is the State Association of Community Action Agencies, and these are anti-poverty organizations born out of the War on Poverty back in the 60s. In Wisconsin, that means 16 community action agencies and two what are called single-purpose agencies. They all work on fighting poverty. They're local, so anyone in your listening area will have a community action agency that services that area. And they all provide direct service ranging from housing assistance, food pantries, job training, literacy, the whole range of anti-poverty programming. We're also, as I said, in addition to being everywhere in the state, that includes, pertinent to this conversation, a lot of rural areas. We have members in Milwaukee and Dane, but most of the member organizations are in geographies that are quite rural, and they see rural poverty from that lens.
And Brad Paul, from what you see, do you have some rough estimates of how many people are experiencing homelessness or home insecurity in Wisconsin's urban, suburban, and rural areas?
Well, this is a tricky question, and it's really at the core of when we talk about rural homelessness. The problem with estimating numbers of homeless in the state or any state, it's a national challenge, is that we have competing definitions of homelessness. So the HUD definition, which is what really drives policy, federal policy, counts those who are in shelters and on the street. That's mostly the extent of what is considered homeless under that definition. By comparison, the Department of Education has a more expansive definition. It includes people who are living in motels, families and children that are doubled, tripled up for lack of an alternative, a more expansive definition that gets at housing insecurity. And for our discussion, that's really where most rural families and homeless individuals fall in that definition. Having said that, when we take those two numbers combined, so when we take the HUD definition, which is arrived at, or the numbers arrived at every couple, twice a year, the state of Wisconsin sends out teams of folks to do a point in time count. That number's up, hovers at around 5,000 per year for the state. That's the point in time count. That's the definition that gets its way, works its way into the media, lands on the desk of policymakers. That's the number. When you take the Department of Public Instruction definition, on the other hand, who have, by school district are counting homeless kids as identified by the school liaisons in those districts. Last year, DPI counted over 17,000 kids throughout the state of Wisconsin who were homeless at some point. So it's a crude estimate, but if you take just those two baseline numbers, you're looking at over 20,000 people in the state of Wisconsin last year who experienced homelessness.
That's Brad Paul, Executive Director of Wisconsin Community Action Program Association, or WISCAP. Also joining us, Michael Hall, Associate Director for Foundations for Living. And Michael, how would you assess the state of people living with homelessness or some form of home insecurity in Waupaca County?
Yeah, I would echo a lot of what Brad had to say when it comes to trying to find numbers and what are those exact numbers. We look at what we have here come through the shelter last year was 43 individuals. But our school district says flat out that there are 60 kids that are homeless in our community, just in the city of Opaca and their school district alone. So it's really hard to put your thumb on a number. And I just think based on whatever the criteria might be is what kind of determines where the numbers come from. But I would just, again, what Brad said was pretty spot on. It's a lot bigger than what the numbers show.
So, Michael, how does Foundations for Living help those who are looking for your services? Do they find you? Do you find them? How did those connections happen?
Well, we're pretty well known in the community. We do have relationships with the county, with local law enforcement. And so anybody that's looking for those types of services, we're pretty well visible. We're a crisis center, a warming shelter. We have a thrift store. We offer recovery services. Those simple things like just food or clothing or help with a water bill, general hygiene products, those sorts of things. So people know where to go when they are in need.
And Brad, Michael seems to be echoing a lot of what you see. How about his assessment in Waupaca County and how you apply that to the rest of Wisconsin right now?
Well, what Michael describes is similar to both the occurrences of homelessness in a lot of these smaller communities, but also the response. An agency like his provides really critical relief, because what they do is they provide the whole range of services, not just one particular program model. That includes transitional housing, which has really been de-emphasized by HUD over the years. A mistake in my estimation, but important that agencies are still doing that along with those sort of wraparound services. It's similar to what CAP agencies do. We provide, meaning our members provide, the whole range, because, you know, as housing advocates, which I consider myself one, we've spent a lot of time over the last 20 years talking about the need for more housing, and that's crucial. That's absolutely fundamental to this story. But we've done less, we've been less successful in pushing for better wages, better income supports, mental health, substance abuse services, counseling. It takes more than just affordable housing, even though that's probably at the center of what we're talking about. And homelessness in rural areas, as I said earlier, really reveals itself differently than it does in an urban area. I mean, you don't have the congregate shelters like you do in a place like Milwaukee or Madison. So you don't see those. You don't see people sleeping on the streets in the same way you do in an urban area. It's the folks, it's the families living in barns, living doubled, tripled up, motels, anywhere they can to keep their kids off the street. That's what you see more commonly in rural areas, and it just doesn't match up with federal policy of the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, and Brad, how do your community action members connect the services for those in need across the state? Do they find you or you find them? How does it work?
Well, like Michael said, our agencies are pretty well known in the community. Most of them have been around since the 60s and 70s. They're well established, trusted resources in those communities. We have some agencies that have sort of three county service areas, others maybe five, six county service areas. Our agency in Milwaukee, the Social Development Commission, is the one CAP agency for that city. So the geographic footprints are different, but the common thread is that all those agencies have been around a while and understand how to address poverty needs in their particular community, because every community is different, obviously.
Michael Hall, why do you think some of the reasons we might overlook as institutions or just individuals, folks who are experiencing homelessness in more rural areas?
Well, like Brad had to say, I've been a volunteer at the warming shelter here before. I was the associate director for about 3 years. And so it's on my radar. And we also do some pastoral ministry in the area. And I've never once seen a person sleeping on a park bench in our community anywhere. I mean, you just don't see it, so you don't know. And that is kind of the biggest thing, is trying to fight something invisible. So you look at people when they come in for other crisis services, and you ask questions, and you try and get to find out from them directly, hey, are you experiencing homelessness? and this is what homelessness looks like. And then that way we're able to meet that need and get them, you know, potentially into, you know, actual housing units in the community or in the shelter if need be. That's kind of the way you have to go about handling it in these rural areas.
And then do schools, especially in rural areas, become one of those contact points as we talk about the numbers of the federal housing and urban development compared to our own state's Department of Public Instruction homelessness?
I mean, I think schools are a touch point, but I don't think that there is a very good continuum of care when it, because typically speaking, that's going to go into the, you know, maybe county social services or perspective, I guess, potentially could be even going to other agencies that aren't connected with our community at all. So it can become difficult to get the information about those students to us so that we can reach out and try and help.
We are exploring how Wisconsin serves its people experiencing home insecurity in rural communities. WPR's Lee Rayburn there spoke with Michael Hall, Associate Director of Foundations for Living in Waupaca County, and Brad Paul, Executive Director of WISCAP. We continue the conversation ahead. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We talk about housing insecurity in the most sparsely populated areas of Wisconsin. This year, the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development announced it would set aside more than $54 million to fund projects addressing homelessness in rural communities. WPR's Lee Rayburn talked about this new funding with leaders from two local organizations. Michael Hall is Associate Director of Foundations for Living in Waupaca County. Brad Paul leads Wisconsin Community Action Program Association. Here's Lee Rayburn speaking with Brad Paul from WISCAP.
What could this housing and urban development funds do to address rural homelessness in Wisconsin?
Well, the announcement's welcome. I mean, obviously, that's a significant amount of money, and that will serve a lot of needs. One of the challenges with the money and the ongoing challenge has been there's a really heavy emphasis on that particular announcement as well on the unsheltered homeless, which we obviously need to include in any strategy, and we need to address the needs of all people experiencing homelessness. But as Michael said before the break, that gets tricky in rural areas when you talk about unsheltered. First of all, there's not many shelters, so even counting that is difficult. But the unsheltered don't reveal themselves as much in rural areas for the reasons that Michael talked about. And so with that as the point of emphasis on this new money, I sometimes fear that we're talking about sort of old strategies and new packaging. And so I'm a little concerned that may be the emphasis a bit misplaced, certainly needed nationally and certainly needed in urban areas. But the grant opportunity includes a lot of money for the homeless system, the continuum of care. And it includes what I think is probably most promising. It includes, I don't know, somewhere in the area of about $40 million, if I'm not mistaken, for vouchers. And I think that will go a long way towards helping address some people's housing needs in rural areas.
Would those be housing vouchers?
Yes, correct.
And Brad, what do you see about the potential funding here from Housing and Urban Development as they focus on rural homelessness or rural home insecurity for pretty much the first time in such a scale?
Well, we've been talking about differences, but one thing that's common, whether it's urban or rural, is that we have a national housing crisis. Yeah. And housing prices are up everywhere. Rent specifically, and we're talking about individuals and families that really are part of the home ownership market. They're renters. Rent is up. Available units are tight. The vacancy rates statewide are very low, below 5%. So the squeeze is on, really, for people, whether you're in urban or rural areas right now with respect to the housing market. And then on top of that, you've got a really sort of a unique dynamic in a rural area where, if a new company comes to town, that creates opportunity, and yet it makes housing costs spike, right? And so you have that along with the flip side of that. If an industry leaves a rural area, then the wages go with that. You know, maybe some players like Wisconsin Rapids and its challenges with the paper mills over the years. So The rural piece is tricky because of those dynamics, but the commonality is housing and housing prices and lack of available units. And so HUD making this kind of investment is good. I think they could probably tweak the approach a little bit to more accommodate the realities in rural areas, but certainly the infusion of dollars and vouchers can only help.
Brad Paul, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Community Action Program Association, otherwise known as WISCAP. Also joining us, Michael Hall, Associate Director for Foundations for Living, which serves Waupaca County. Michael Hall, is the solution as simple as housing?
Yes and no. I mean, it's certainly we need more housing, but when you're looking at the general clientele that we're dealing with on a pretty regular basis, you have to contend with background checks and credit checks and those sorts of things. And even if it's not really that they have particularly bad credit, but perhaps, you know, when 10 years ago they are facing an eviction and that's on their record, you can have a lot of houses and a lot of empty houses if they can't pass the checks to get in. And that's pretty common an issue across the state, so far as I can tell.
We turn now to Steve in Chippewa Falls.
Thank you for taking my call. My first thought is, are we defining ourselves into a homeless problem by saying only so many people can live in a home together and sort of making rules that didn't exist back in the 50s and 60s and 70s when a big family would live in a relatively small house? And I wonder if there's that. And then number two, if you just have vouchers and vouchers, are you putting some people in and driving other people out because you're just driving up the cost of housing by pouring more money onto the inflation fire? And the third thing is, if you've been at this for 60 years and the problem isn't being solved, it's getting worse and worse and worse, should we maybe take a different tact and turn this sort of, take this away from government agencies and turn it back to maybe ask the churches, ask the local groups to house local people and take it away from being a government function?
Steve,
both my questions, I'll listen.
You brought up a litany there, so let's go down the list. And Brad, I'll turn to you. Are vouchers, the potential of vouchers, only going to create inflation and worsen the housing crisis?
Well, no, I don't know if I would subscribe to that. I mean, we've been retreating from investment in housing for 40 years now. And to sort of turn this over or sort of to close the circle on his questions about government, the challenge that we have is that what we're talking about are the lowest income renters possible, right? And so the market generally doesn't build housing for that sector. And so because of that, it's really up to the government to fill that space. He mentioned the really crucial role that churches and charities play, and I agree with that. But they're not able to create housing on the scale that we're talking about. And so if we're going to fill that gap, which is significant, in the state of Wisconsin, you've got 150,000 households that are paying more than 50% of their income on housing. If you're going to fill that gap, you really need some alternative to the private sector, and historically that's been the government, less so over the last 40 years, and I think we have to reckon with that finally.
So from your perspective, the government's actually pulled back over the last 40 years. Churches, community organizations, they've always been involved and will continue to be.
100%. Valuable partner in it all.
That was WPR's Lee Rayburn on homelessness. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.